everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me today for It's All About Food. It's November 11, 2014, and I am here with a very special guest who happens to be in New York for a little book tour. I have with me Kim Stallwood, and his book is Growl. We spoke about it a few months ago on this show, and now we're going to talk a little bit more about it. Kim is an independent scholar and author on animal rights for almost 40 years, and he has demonstrated personal commitment and professional experience in leadership positions with some of the world's foremost animal advocacy organizations in the UK and the USA, and that includes Compassion in World Farming, British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and the Animals Agenda magazine. He founded the Animals and Society Institute in 2005, and he has been a vegan since 1976. Wow. Hi, Kim. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so how are you feeling here in New York?
I'm feeling good. It's great to be back in the city and in the United States. I was very privileged to live and work here for 20 years, but about 7 years ago, returned to live in the UK, where I'm from. But I really enjoy being in the US again.
And what events have you had here since you've been here in New York?
Well, there's been a wide variety of events. One of the first events was a public lecture at New York University, which was hosted by the Animals and Society Initiative. Subsequent to that, I've had various meetings with individuals and representatives of organizations. Tomorrow I leave the city to go to Baltimore for a week, where I will be based and doing presentations in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia.
Okay, we spoke, when was it? About 6 months ago or so? I can't quite remember. But since that time, has the book changed since it's come out?
The book has not changed. What has changed is the response that I'm getting from readers to the book. And that is influencing me and my thinking about the book and about the second book, which I'm now working on. For example, yesterday I had a very gracious email from a reader who said that the book really spoke to them. They found themselves wanting to read out sections to it to their friends because it was describing exactly how they were feeling. So it was very nice to get those kind of feedbacks from readers.
Many of us who have been doing this for a long time, especially when we started a long time ago, we didn't have a community, we didn't have resources, or if they were out there, it was hard to find them. And that's one good thing about your book for those who are just getting started or have been around a while. We know we're not alone.
Yes, indeed, we're not alone. And in writing Growl, I very much set out to write the book I wished I could have read when I first got involved with the issue in the 1970s, with the issue being animal rights. So it's a look back, but it's also a look forward, and I hope that it's a book that's going to empower people to understand how far we've traveled and how much further we've got to go.
Okay, the title. I know you've been through a variety of titles before you came to Growl, but who's growling?
I'm growling.
What are you growling about?
Well, as the self-proclaimed grumpy vegan, which is how you can follow me on Twitter as grumpy vegan, I am growling about two things in the book called Growl. One is that it's a memoir of my involvement with animal rights, how I discovered the animal issue. And this was partly due to the fact that I worked as a student in a chicken slaughterhouse and the impact that that had on me, or rather the impact, I should say, on the only vegetarian I knew at the time, who I argued with about what I had been responsible for, and she convinced me that I should go vegetarian. And that was the beginning of 1974, and then one thing led on to another from there. But I also growl about a manifesto for change. And as I look back over my life and my activities, I reflect upon four key values in animal rights, which are compassion, truth, nonviolence, and justice.
Those are four big things.
They are four big things. They're universals, which don't exclusively apply only to animal rights, I think. They also apply to social justice in more broad terms.
Mm-hmm. I love those four concepts. Unfortunately, I think people may have different understandings of what compassion is. There are a lot of people that think they're compassionate, and yet some people may not think they're either compassionate enough or... And then truth. We want to think that there is one truth, but people have their way with things and interpret things the way they want to.
Yes, of course, it's very complicated, and people are entitled to however they choose to define these words. But for me, what compassion stands out from pity or sympathy or empathy, what makes compassion different for me is that compassion is what I experience when I see an animal suffering, whether I see an animal suffering in real life or whether I see a video or a photograph of animal suffering. And I can intuitively feel what that animal is experiencing, the suffering that they're enduring, and it provokes me to want to act for them on their behalf. And that's the key difference, I think, about compassion, is that it not only makes me intuitively know what they're experiencing, but it compels me to want to do something about it.
So we mentioned the good thing about this book is it's a great resource for people that are either getting started or have been in the movement for a long time, and it shows us we are not alone. The difficult thing for activism, probably all activism, is when things don't go our way. And it happens over and over and over. And then we end up in this place that you have labeled. I love this place. I've been here too many times lately. The misanthropic bunker.
Yes.
Get me out, Kim.
Well, Karen, you're on your own. You have to get yourself out of the misanthropic bunker. I can't help you. I'm sorry. I find myself often in the misanthropic bunker. This is the place I end up going when I really do get fed up with the world. I get fed up with the people, I get fed up with the animal rights movement, I feel that we're not making any progress, that things are going backwards, animals are suffering now, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I allow myself, I've learned to allow myself, spend a little bit of time in the misanthropic bunker, because these emotions are natural reactions to living in a world which is built upon animal cruelty and exploitation. We can do a lot in our lives. We can change our lives. We may not be able to change the world, although we should try. But in trying to change our lives in the world, we will end up, I think, in the misanthropic bunker. So spend time there, but know that if you try and do anything for animals from the misanthropic bunker, it will be negative. It won't be helpful to anyone. So you've got to learn to be able to get yourself out of the misanthropic bunker. And then once you're out, get back to the fight and campaign for animal rights.
What gets you out? Vegan treats or something?
Oh, I don't know if I want to say in public what gets me out. What does get me out? Okay, let me see if I can answer this question for you. Well, there are a number of things that get me out. I realize that I have to get myself back out because I have to keep going. It's a bit like learning how to ride a bicycle. You fall off a couple of times and you know that's what you got to do, and you just get back on the saddle and keep going again.
You know, we just had elections here in the United States, and the results brought me back to the misanthropic bunker because they were just so disappointing. And I really wonder what people are thinking when they vote. So where are you on the importance of regulation to make change? And have you been involved in that side of activism?
I have been involved in that side of activism. I think that when we look at campaigning for animal rights, we are looking at a number of avenues and a number of strategies. One is to persuade people to change their lifestyles and become vegetarian and vegan and buy cruelty-free products and services and not wear leather and wool and so on and so forth. But there's also the fact that we need to turn to regulations and to the law, because unfortunately not everyone is going to be vegan, and we need laws to protect animals. So yes, we have to get involved with the legislative process. We have to get involved with the development of public policy.
Okay, so that leads me to the next question, which I've been asking a lot of people on this show, which is polarization. We, especially in this animal rights community, this vegan community, we seem to be polarizing to one side or another, an all-or-nothing side or making small steps to get to a better place. And regulation is involved with this because a lot of organizations are actually promoting different types of regulation that move slowly, but they believe they're making positive change, going from a small cage to a little larger cage or getting the pigs out of gestation crates. And you know, a variety of different things, and then the other people feel like, no, we cannot say that making things a little better for the animals is okay. They have to get out of the cage. Where are you in this big picture?
My position is that I think that we need to strike a balance between what I call utopian vision and the pragmatic politics. On the one hand, we need to convey the final endpoint that we would like to go to, which is a vegan world. And to get to the vegan world is going to be a complicated and a long, messy process. Life is very complicated, it's very messy. There is no simple route from A to B. So we want a vegan world, and we should campaign for a vegan world. And some people will have a preference to only focus on the vegan world, and that is great. I wish them every success. But for me, the position that I'm in is that whilst I simultaneously campaign for a vegan world, I also accept that the reality of the political situation is that when we talk about regulation and legislation and public policy, we can talk about the vegan ideal to some extent, but probably we're going to end up talking about some middle ground of some kind or another. And where you draw the line of the middle ground and what you're comfortable campaigning for on is really up to the individual. In some situations, it's going to be closer to the vegan ideal. In other situations, it's going to be a bit further away from the vegan ideal. There are lines that I won't cross, things that I'm not comfortable supporting. I think that the issue of getting companies to change the policies of the way in which they raise animals is very important because businesses consume animal products and animals' lives in doing so. And what we need to do is persuade them to change the ways in which they raise animals. And sometimes I am uncomfortable with some of the activities that lead to that, but other times I recognize this is a necessary step, because when we have a large corporation that adopts a more enlightened policy about the way they raise animals, it's probably going to pave the way for a legislation at a later date. But life is very complicated, life is very messy, simplistic positions are all well and good, and I am a vegan, I've always campaigned for veganism, but I do recognize that from time to time, particularly in the political arena, we have to talk about realpolitik, as it's known.
I like to say sometimes that I am an out vegan. How do you feel about the word vegan? There are all kinds of conversations about whether we should be using this word. We're using vegetarian. It's more approachable. Some people like plant-based, plant-strong, blah, blah, blah.
Mm. Vegan isn't a word that I don't have a problem with, so I always use the word vegan. A similar situation is one with what do we mean when we say animal welfare and animal rights, and then it gets a bit more complicated. On one level, it isn't complicated. When we talk about animal rights, we're talking about animals, the right to respect, the right to bodily integrity, the right not to be eaten, to be experimented on, and all the rest of it. But in Britain, for example, where I now live again, the term animal rights has a connotation to it, which, frankly, the mainstream media has helped cultivate, which is, it means, when you say animal rights in Britain, it means violent direct action toward animals. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily mean the philosophy of animal rights. So traditionally, in Britain, people say animal welfare more than animal rights. And so I find myself in times in Britain actually saying animal welfare when I actually mean animal rights, and sometimes I say animal rights when I mean animal rights. So at heart, I'm animal rights, and I do try to use the language of animal rights whenever I think it's most appropriate. But every now and then, I think that I have to use the phrase animal welfare in order to address the audience or the situation that I'm in. But really what I mean is animal rights.
It's not exactly the same here in the United States, as you know, but many people do attribute animal rights. They see violence as associated with animal rights, and unfortunately our government is starting to use the word terrorists a bit more with people who are advocating for animal rights because of a select few people who did some things that might be perceived as a bit too violent, either destroying a lab or something like that.
My third key value that I talk about in Growl is nonviolence. And the reason why I do that is severalfold. First off, I think that what we do to animals is violence. It is violent behavior. To kill and abuse animals, to experiment with them, to subject them to rodeos, to imprison them in zoos or marine mammal displays, these are acts of violence. And I see them bluntly for that. And in thinking about the fact that that is violent behavior, and the fact that we want to create a world in which that violent behavior doesn't exist, I think we are responsible in turn as individuals to behave non-violently. We behave non-violently when we adopt a vegan, cruelty-free lifestyle. And so when we talk about the actions that we do for animals, I think they should all be grounded in non-violence. Non-violence starts with each of us, and as each of us become non-violent, I think then we can build a non-violent society.
I'm just taking that in. Now, before, this struck me when you said the right not to be eaten. There's something that really strikes me. I haven't heard it quite put that way before. And that just gets to me when I say that. The right not to be eaten. I mean, can you imagine people feeling that way, campaigning for the right not to be eaten? It's just crazy. I mean, that just puts it right down to what it is.
That's basically what it's all about, is the right for animals not to be eaten, or for anyone. I mean, what if we eat animals, why don't we eat human bodies? We are animals. Our bodies are the flesh, the muscle, the sinew, that when we eat meat, that's exactly what we eat. And, you know, there have been situations in the past, and I'm sure there'll be other situations in the future, where people have eaten other people. We actually eat very few different types of animals. There's a very small number of animals that people do eat, and but most of those animals are intensively farmed and raised by the thousands and millions and billions. Eating meat doesn't really benefit anyone, and I do predict that we will see in years to come, not that far away, the collapse of factory farming, because it's a grossly uneconomic, inefficient form of producing food. It causes a tremendous amount of pollution. It's the result of a great deal of human disease and as well, of course, the animal suffering. And at some point, all of it is going to collapse because it just consumes far more in resources than it actually produces when people momentarily sit and eat a piece of chicken.
I'm not looking forward to that collapse. And unfortunately, listening to what the United States government and other governments want to do and promote, they're still focused on factory farming in order to feed the growing population.
The British government has a rather stupid phrase that it's using, which is sustainable intensification.
Oh, gosh.
But I think that the course of fate is beyond our control, and there is an inevitability to the fact that I think factory farming will close down. But what's also happening that is particularly exciting, and I think we can take great prospect in, is the fact that there is a tremendous amount of resources put into the cultivation of meat grown in a test tube. And I don't want to necessarily eat that food myself, but I think for the vast majority of people who do want to experience and enjoy and take pleasure from eating the flesh of animals, if this flesh of animals is grown in a test tube and doesn't cause the amount of animal suffering that the other ways do, or cause the environmental degradation that the other ways do, then I'm all for it. And I think that at some point soon we'll see that the production of cultured meats and also artificial cow's milks, that these are going to become economically viable, and they're going to also help tip factory farming into the dustbin of history.
This is one of the things that puts me in the misanthropic bunker, because it's clear to me that if you have enough money behind a product, and because some small group think they're going to profit from it, they're able to do enough marketing to convince a certain amount of the population to want that product, whether it's good or not. It's all about marketing. And so I'm sure there are companies that are going to convince people to want to eat cultured meat. And there's a variety of responses to it right now where people have the ew factor. I personally have the ew factor with eating live animals. But there are plenty of things that people eat today. They have no idea what it is, where it comes from, what's done to it, and they don't mind. It comes in a pretty package, and it has nice commercials, and they have learned to like it. And you can learn to unlike these foods, too. There are things that I used to eat as a child that if they came in, I mean, I smelled them sometimes just passing a restaurant or a store, and it's vile. So there's a lot of things that we can learn and unlearn. And what puts me back in the misanthropic bunker is letting other people decide our fate, other people make our opinions, and we don't even realize it's happening.
No, well, I agree with you. I think that I, as a consumer in mainstream media, are very I have a rather jaded view as you, and I try to control and limit my exposure to mainstream media to that which I think is actually essential for me to keep up to date with events, and then go to other sources of information.
Like Progressive Radio Network, woohoo!
Indeed, if I was living in America, I would live in I would listen to this station.
You could hear it on the internet.
I'm sure. You know, and as soon as I was saying that, I thought Karen's going to come back to me and say, "You can hear it on the internet, Kim."
Okay. Whew. All right. Let's get back to the book, Growl. And this is a project that's taken many years. Have you discovered anything either about yourself or about the movement along the way?
I discovered things about myself because the book forced me to look back on my life and figure out why I ended up where I've ended up, working for as long as I have for various animal rights organizations in Britain and America. And one of the most interesting things is that it forced me to look back on my childhood and in the town in England where I was born and raised, think back to when I was about five, to a woman who was a dog rescuer, and she was known as Camberley Kate. Camberley is the name of the town where I was born and raised, and her real name was Kate Ward. And Kate Ward was a very small, feisty, elderly lady who dedicated many years of her life to rescuing unwanted dogs. And she lived with something like 30 or so dogs. And what she would do every Saturday is that she would take a small wooden cart that was painted green that had her name, Camberley Kate Ward, on the front, and she would put the sick and elderly dogs in the cart, and she would tie all the other dogs to the sides of the cart, and she would then push this cart like a pram or a stroller through the town and force everyone to see what she was doing for animals. And I can remember as a very small boy standing on the side of the road and watching her come up the high street, up the main street, against the one-way traffic, and force people to see what she was doing. And she made me question why do people do things for other people. In her case, she was doing this for dogs, but it made me wonder, why do people do such extraordinary things? And that was one of the revelations I had about the book, was that I realized now that she had more of a significant impact on my life than I had anticipated.
It's amazing sometimes what can happen to us when we're young that impacts us that way. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. A lot of people discover that they have kind of traumatic things that happened to them when they were young, and it affects them so dramatically later on. But for you, it was a good thing.
That was a good thing, yes.
That's good. Okay. Oh, let's talk about, I like talking about cultures. So you know the United States and you know the UK, and you've been in both and you've back and forth. Where is the UK relative to animal welfare versus the United States? I don't know what term to use anymore, but is anybody better than the other? Are we doing some things good or bad, and they're doing some things good and bad?
I think it's a mixed report. I think it depends upon the area that you look at. And I think some of the advantages of this culture of America, which we don't have in Britain, means that you are far more advanced in that area. So, for example, I'm thinking particularly of animal law. Britain isn't... we do obviously have legislation, we have laws, we have courts, but we don't make legislation through laws in the court in the way in which you do here. So the ability to be able to sue the government, to sue corporations, although I know there is a challenge to do that, but the ability to do that in this country is far more than we have it available to us in America. So the development of animal law and the teaching of animal law in increasing numbers of law schools around America, that is something that's happening right now that's a very exciting development. And we just don't have that in Britain as much as you do in this country. And I think that's more to do with the differences between the countries than necessarily the movement. I think another area that's important is that in Britain, when we look at the lives of cats and dogs and other companion animals, generally speaking, those companion animals in Britain are embraced as members of the family, and they live with the people in their home. They will be fully members of their family. We don't have the practice of chaining outdoor dogs and never bringing a dog indoors, for example. That's really very, very rare and really unheard of. And if it were to happen in Britain, I think most people would say that it was a truly bad thing.
I didn't know that. Thank you, America. We do all kinds of interesting things here, unfortunately. Okay, are you aware of the lawyer Steve Weiss and the non-human rights movement, where he's got a case right now in New York trying to get Tommy the chimp out of a difficult situation?
Yes, I am following it from a distance, and I really appreciate the fact that he's pioneering this work, and I really hope that I believe he will be very successful in these efforts. It's already been a success because it's attracted so much attention, and it has put the issue of animal exploitation so sensibly, so squarely into the public discourse that I think it's already had a tremendous victory.
I would like to be in the minds of the judges who have to decide these cases, because at some point they really have to realize this guy's got a point, but do I have the balls to do something about it?
Yes, I would like to be that judge and make that decision, but I'm not. And those judges have got a difficult situation in front of them, because they're not going to be as familiar with it as we all are, and I'm sure it's a decision for some of them they'd rather not have to face. But it's going to be an interesting historical precedent, and Steve Wise has looked back on the development of the end of slavery and the slave trade in Britain, and is drawing from the historical past to try and help set a precedent for the future for animal rights, and that's very exciting.
Now, you got involved in this, well, you've been vegan since 1976, which is a long time. Did you have any mentors, either at that time or along the way? You've been doing it a long time, and the internet wasn't around, so how did you put it all together?
Well, I can't. It's difficult now to imagine that we ever did put anything together without the internet.
Isn't it? How did we do anything?
How did we do anything? I really don't
know. I used the yellow pages for a lot of things
back
then.
Well, we had to do airmail letters, and every now and then, if there was an urgency, we had to phone transatlantically. And I was thinking that the first time I came to America was 1980. So that's, that's 34 mm-hmm. years ago. So a lot has happened in that time, both in terms of animal rights, both in terms of our ability as campaigners. But you asked me about mentors. Well, over the years, there's been a series of people who have been greatly influential to me, and there are actually probably far too many to list here. And if I start listing people who are alive, I probably will have other people I know who I haven't mentioned who complained to me that I didn't list them. So let's think about a couple of people who are no longer with us. I mean, one of them is Henry Salt, who was a English gentleman who went to Eton School, which is a very important private school in England, and he, many royalty and other wealthy individuals go there. He also ended up teaching there, but he basically dropped out, and he had become a vegetarian. He was greatly concerned about the environment. He was what was called an ethical socialist, and he started an organization called the Humanitarian League. And the Humanitarian League campaigned for a wide range of issues relating to people, animals, and the environment. And he packaged them all together as a one comprehensive worldview. And he really was in the forefront of his time of seeing the integration of animal issues with human issues and the environment. And his work is amazing to read. He was a very great writer. He was a very witty writer. And he was very well connected with George Bernard Shaw and others. And he's always been someone who I've looked up to and enjoyed reading his work and learning about his life.
I haven't read anything by him. I've got to add that to my list.
Well, one of the most important books that he wrote is a book that's simply called Animals' Rights. And the subtitle is Considered in Relation to Social Progress. And Peter Singer's book, In Animal Liberation, in the introduction, he does cite Henry Salt as a great influence as well.
I'm not going to mention any names, but I've been thinking recently about some people that we consider leaders in this vegan movement or vegetarian movement aren't even vegan or vegetarian, and yet we give them credit for moving us in this direction, and then we take it to a even more further place.
Who do you have in mind?
Oh, I'll tell you later. but it's kind of interesting.
It is interesting.
Well, what happens is when people discover that these people that they really look up to don't commit to the same ideals that they do, they get angry, which is unfortunate because, you know, we're all on a journey. We're all on a path. We're all figuring out this messy world together like you talk about.
And none of us are perfect. And I
think,
well, perhaps I'm more perfect than you, Karen, but none of us are perfect. And I think the striving for perfection is a real problem. And what we need to do is think of veganism as a journey and not a destination. When we think of it as a journey that is a destination that we'll never get to, then I think that our minds are better able to equip ourselves with all the challenges and the difficulties and contradictions that we have to resolve.
I used to ask people where they are on the food continuum, and I saw it linearly, where you had meat eaters on one side and vegans on the other. But now I'm starting to think it's three-dimensional. It's not two-dimensional. There are so many different issues that are involved with food that it goes out in many, many directions.
Well, being vegan is more than just the food that we eat. It's also all about not wearing leather, not consuming honey, not wearing wool. And I would also argue, and this is essentially what the mission of what Growl is all about, it's also to do with the way in which we think, the way in which we speak, and the things that we do. And that's why I crafted the idea of these four key values of truth, compassion, nonviolence, and justice, because I think that truth, compassion, nonviolence, and justice are actually the key values of veganism.
I'm sure you've influenced many, many people along the way in your work. Have there been people who have come to you like decades later that finally get it?
There have been a few over the years who have come back to me and said, "Oh, do you remember X, Y, and Z?" And usually I end up having to say, "No, I'm sorry, I don't," because I'm very bad at remembering people and situations. And I know that you and I were in a situation once which I had completely forgotten about, and it was a protest that we took part in, and you had to remind me about it, and I thought, oh yes, that was right. But yes, there have been people over the years who've come back to me, and that's always very gratifying when that happens.
Some of the things that I don't remember that people help me remember, some of them aren't so good. So over the years, in my own activism, I've changed my strategy. I think I take a softer, more compassionate approach than I did when I was younger and in everybody's face. And people will remind me of that. Do you remember we had lunch and you said blah, blah, blah? Mm. No, I don't want to remember that.
Well, I relate to that very much. And Oscar Wilde says something about that youth is wasted on the young. And when we're young, we have more freedom, perhaps, to be able to think, say, and do the things that we do and not be so aware of the consequences of what we think, say, and do. But fortunately, age does bring some sort of deeper understanding of the world, and we do change and adapt. And even though I think that I have changed, in many respects, I really haven't changed. I'm really in the same place as far as being outraged about animal cruelty and exploitation. That hasn't changed, and I will always be in that place.
Okay, so let's take the Kim Stallwood from 2014 and put him in 1976, what would you do differently? If you knew what you knew now.
If I knew what I knew now, what would I do differently from what I'd done in 1976? Gosh, that is such a... I hate you, Karen, for asking me that question. That's such a difficult question to answer on a radio station.
Okay, let me say
something about... I think I perhaps would be a bit... I would... be more willing to accept. I think I would be less compulsive about trying to be vegan, which doesn't mean to say that I'm not vegan, but I know that there are situations where I cannot control everything that I deal with, and in those situations you have to make value judgments. And so I think this, what I didn't know in 1976 was understanding veganism as a journey, not a destination. I thought when I was young, when I was 21 and I became vegan, that I had arrived. And not only had I arrived at where I wanted to be, that the animal rights movement began its history when I became a vegan. And it took me a long while to learn that there was actually a lot of other people who preceded me, who did a lot of great work, who preceded me, and I had to learn that all those people existed. So I was quite, as is not unusual when you're young, you know, quite arrogant and conceited, and hopefully I'm less arrogant, less conceited now. So I would say that I would want to know then that I know now is to think about veganism as a journey and not destination.
There have been a lot of people that came before you. Like Pythagoras to begin with, probably even somebody before him.
I'm sure there were, and we stand on their shoulders.
Yeah.
And there are going to be people who are going to stand on our shoulders thereafter. And what is important is that we use our lives as much as we're able to advance the cause of justice for animals.
Okay, you finished this book, Growl, and you're out and about talking about it. I want to say you must feel some relief finishing it, but now you've got another one?
Yes, I'm working on the second book, which begins where Growl ends, which is talking about the animal rights movement in Britain and in America and doing an evaluation of it. And if truth were to be told, I have to say that when I was writing Growl, I made the mistake, which a lot of authors do when they try to write their first book, is that you try to cram as much in as possible. And I suddenly realized I was actually writing several books at once because I was writing things in the first person and in the third person. So once I realized that, I had to sort of surgically take it apart and then rebuild it and identify the several different books I'm writing. So the second book is focusing on the animal rights movement and doing a critical evaluation of it.
And where are you in that journey? How far have you gotten?
I am working on the manuscript now, and if I can get the manuscript done by the end of next year, I will be quite happy. These things take an enormous amount of time. Unfortunately, I have to do other projects as well. If this was just exclusively all I had to do, it would be done much sooner.
Okay, so I don't want you to blow the ending of this book, but is there a happy ending? Are we doing good?
We are doing good, but I think we can do better.
Oh, gosh, we can do better, can't we? Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you've had some really good responses to the book, and you mentioned one. Can you let us know what other people have been thinking and saying?
They have been commenting on the fact that they read the book and it speaks to them and says what they've been thinking, but they've never been able to sort of sort out their thoughts in a rational way. So it's helped to articulate for them what their garbled thoughts have been thinking. And I relate to that very much because I know, and I do talk about this in Growl, that when I read some of the books written about animal rights from a philosophical point of view, and some of them are quite difficult to read, but when I have read them or heard philosophers speak about animal rights, they say something in such a way, and I think, gosh, that's what I think. And they're helping me articulate what I've been thinking, but it's all jumbled up thoughts in my head, and they've been able to unravel them. So that's come to some of the things which I've been hearing from readers. That's what they've been saying.
It is messy, isn't it? Outside and inside our heads.
We are a real mess. I mean, the human animal is a bundle of contradictions and hypocrisies, and we struggle with that every day.
Okay, so there are a lot of different organizations out there doing different work, and you've founded a few and been involved with a few. Are there any you can say on public radio that you like, or that you like specific things about what they're doing?
Oh, Karen, that's a very naughty question to ask me. I'm not going to...
I'm
not going to...
I'm asking all the naughty questions.
You're asking all the naughty questions. I mean, I think that there are organizations... Look at the... let me answer this question this way. There are organizations which are really in the forefront of the activities. So let me talk about activities that I like. I like activities which shine the spotlight of on animal cruelty, which expose animal cruelty and document their exploitation. So these are undercover investigations. I think they're very, very important. I like protests which throw back to society a vision of their exploitation of animals. So one form of protest I like is a formation of individuals standing in lines. Each person is holding a dead animal in that formation, and that's a very powerful image. I like open rescues, which is when people go into where animals are abused. They go in fully identifying who they are. They cause virtually no damage in going into these facilities, which is chicken battery cages, for example, and they help the animals as much as they can. They document it, and they report back to society on what they've seen. So I like the idea of witnessing for animals, and those kind of examples of the protesting by holding up individual dead animals in a respectful way and documenting their abuse in open rescues, they're the kind of activities which I think are really important. There's also obviously the importance of public education and being an example as a vegan and telling people about what goes on and encouraging them. There's also the important action of actually enjoying vegan food. I love my...
I'm saving that for last, yeah.
Okay, well, I like my food, and I like my food to be vegan, and I enjoy my food. And I think sharing vegan meals with people who aren't vegan is one of the best ways to educate people.
Now, we have some laws in the United States, in certain states, and unfortunately they make it more and more difficult to do rescues and to go into a facility because we'd be branded a terrorist at this point. And even though some facilities are violating the few laws that we have, it's really hard to expose that. Do you have the same thing in the UK?
Fortunately, we don't have the same thing in the UK. I know that they're trying to get these so-called ag-gag laws. There's talk of them in Europe, and there's certainly talk about them in Australia. My take on the ag-gag laws is that I think they're going to be a temporary phenomena. I don't think they're going to survive in the course of time because they're going to be challenged in the courts as a part of the freedom of speech. And I think they're also going to, the public is going to see them, and they're going to reflect badly on animal farming because they will, it's self-evident that they're trying to hide what they're doing. They're trying to take steps to further hide what they do to animals. And I think the public are going to see ag-gag laws for what they are, which is censoring the public's understanding of what farmers do.
That's what they're doing, censoring. Yep. Not a good thing at all. Well, you have somewhat positive outlook about the future. I like that. From a grumpy vegan.
Well, I have a positive outlook today, Karen, because I'm with you.
Oh, that's sweet. And you've got a lot of people all around you that are excited about what you're doing. That's got to feel good.
Yes, it does feel good.
All these parties.
Well, I don't know about all these parties, Karen. I don't know what parties you're going to, but...
Okay. People like to follow celebrities, and we have a few who have gone vegan, vegan-ish, like former President Bill Clinton and some others. Do you have them in the UK, too? The political leaders, specifically, who have stood out to promote vegetables?
I'm very pleased to say that we actually have three vegan MPs.
Wow.
An MP is a member of Parliament, roughly the equivalent to the House of Commons is where the MPs are, and that's roughly the equivalent to the House of Representatives. And there are three vegan MPs. One of those three vegan MPs is someone who, in the 1980s, I stood alongside on various animal rights protests, and it's really thrilling for me to see him become an elected member of Parliament. There's also another colleague from the animal rights days of the 1980s who is now in the House of Lords, and she is what's known as a lady, and she is a vegetarian. So there are people who do stand out, and one of the most prominent celebrities that we have who are speaking out for animals is Brian May, the guitarist with the rock band Queen. And I'm very lucky to have that he wrote the foreword to my book, Growl. Mm. And he's a super smart guy. He's got a PhD in astrophysics. But he's a very down-to-earth man, and he cares really deeply about animals. His passion is genuine and runs deep.
Okay. I just had a thought that went poof. Don't you love when that happens? I don't.
Is it a vegan blank?
It's I need more DHA. We were just talking about this on the last show with Brenda Davis, who's this wonderful registered dietitian in Canada. Are you familiar with Brenda? She's just awesome. I called her a superhero, and every time one of us forgets something, I'm always recommending we need more DHA, at least a little more flaxseed or chia seeds. Are you into chia seeds?
No, I'm not.
I'm not either, and they seem to be quite trendy lately, but I haven't been able to really want any of that.
No, it's a trend that's passed me by.
I don't mind flax seeds as much, but it's really important to get those omega-3 fatty acids in our bodies if we want to be productive for a long time in our activism, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, we want to be radiant and healthy as much as we possibly can. So when I was asking you about organizations that you liked what they're doing, there are a number of big organizations, and they're successful in their fundraising, and they get a lot of support. But there's so many more small organizations popping up, little kind of mom-and-pop things on the Internet, people with websites and blogs. I can't keep track of them. It's difficult for many of us to make a living doing something like this, and it's very time-consuming. It can be a nice hobby for some, but it is literally a business for many of us, and it's challenging, but kind of exciting that there are so many of us out there doing what we can.
I think this is one of the benefits of the Internet age, which is that it's enabling people as individuals and as groups of individuals. It's empowering them to do things and to have a big impact. It's really causing a massive expansion of activities. And I really welcome that. Crowdfunding is also making it possible for people to help other people. All our fundraising activities is also changing as well. So part of my life is that I work as a consultant for various animal welfare and rights organizations in Britain and America, and I can see that through the work that they do, that they're having to adapt and change to these things. So I think that it's a good time. It's a good time to be active for animals. We've got a lot of potential in the resources available to us. And having said that, though, I think there's also a worry that we need to think about as far as the Internet is concerned, and that is that we need to train ourselves to be mindful, to be able to sort the wheat from the chaff, if you like. Because there is a lot out there on the Internet, and we need to be able to discern those voices which are genuine, which are truthful and honest and accurate, from those which aren't.
One of the things that drives me nutty is sometimes some website or someone will be promoting a link to some activity, and it's a link that takes you somewhere. And then I always wonder, where did it start? Where did this information come from? I'm always looking for the primary source. And, some people will post something on their site, and it really should be just a link that goes to the original site, because the person who created it should be getting the credit. And there's a lot of that kind of pirating going around. But primary sources on the internet and in books is so important, because a lot of the same crap sound bites just keep getting repeated, and some of them are just wrong.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that if we want to be accurate and truthful in what we say, we do need to go to the source of the information as much as possible. So in that regard, I think that speaks to the need of books, and books being published and books being written, because books have a longevity about them. Some books obviously don't have a longevity, but mostly books do have a longevity. They are recognized vehicles of information, and they stand the test of time. And some websites can be more trusted than others. I think it's fairly easy to see websites which just aggregate information and recycle it. I've seen many of those, and once I realize a website is basically doing that and not an original source of information, I generally don't bother with them.
I agree with you, Kim. I believe in creating original information.
Well, I'm sure, I'm pleased to hear you do agree with me, Karen.
You know, I have a nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, and we archive our shows from Progressive Radio Network up there, but everything that's up there is original or commentary on something that's occurred, but it's new information, not grabbed from somewhere else. All right, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about food. So before we get to the most delicious part about food, just what do you think about these companies like Beyond Meat and Beyond Egg? We talked a little bit about cultured meat, which, ew. I think it's ew. But Beyond Meat and Beyond Eggs, what about them? They're meat and egg made from plants.
It's something I don't want to eat, because I don't want to eat those products, because I actually don't enjoy eating the products which replicate meat. There's something about the visceral experience of eating meat that I find frankly repulsive. Tempeh is something that I really choose not to eat, because I don't like the experience of it. However, having said that, I really welcome these developments, because when those industries become cost-effective and economic, and they can replace the production of animals to produce those foods, then, and if that's what the vast majority of people want to eat, and it doesn't involve animal cruelty and exploitation, and it's a much more efficient way of producing food, then I will be very happy.
I want you to be happy.
Well, I'd like to be happy too, Karen.
I do love tempeh, and I don't love it because I feel like I'm having meat. I think it's a really unique food, but maybe you don't like it because it's fermented. I think some people really have some kind of reaction to that.
It could be the fermentation, but there is something I'm quite sensitive about this, and in that anything that when I eat on it and chew on it, if it gives me the feeling or reminds me of the sensation of eating meat, I really don't like it. So I often just avoid all those sorts of products. I like tofu, and I like what you can do with tofu, and I like my food, but those sorts of things I really don't like.
All right, let's talk about Kim's food, because I know you like to cook, and you're probably pretty good at it.
Well, I'd like to think I'm good at it. My partner, Gary, he's also a very good cook, so between us, we look after ourselves pretty well. My favorite cuisines are going to be Italian and Mediterranean. I also like Indian and Greek as well. So they're mainly fresh fruits and vegetables, pasta, grains and cereals. I do like some macrobiotic foods as well, brown rice, sauteed vegetables and brown rice. I like simple foods. I like fresh foods, simply produced. Unfortunately, I do have a bit of a sweet tooth, so I do like my desserts, and I often do the baking in our home, and Gary does the main courses. And I've had some very good meals whilst I've been here in New York.
That was my next question. Oh. Where have you been? Have people been cooking for you, or have you been to some of our fine restaurants?
I have been to some really excellent restaurants. Outstanding restaurant is the New Candle Cafe.
West.
That's
just a few blocks from here.
It is just a few blocks from here. And I was just so amazed by that, by the experience, the service, the atmosphere of the restaurant, and the food was fabulous.
What did you have? You didn't have their tempeh.
No, I didn't have their tempeh. And, of course, I can't remember what I did eat either.
Need DHA.
I do. I can tell you that it was Saturday evening, but I cannot tell you what I ate. Oh. But I know that it was fabulous.
Right.
It was really, really good.
They also, I don't know if they still do, but they had a great happy hour, and they were serving really inexpensive organic beer.
Now you tell me.
Yeah, if you sit at the bar, which for prices you can't get in Manhattan. So that was exciting when I discovered it. Like I said, I don't know if they're still doing it.
I'm really excited for Candle Cafe to see them grow from the original first restaurant to the Candle on 79 and now to this one. And I think, you know, in many ways they're emblematic of the growth of vegan cuisine in this city. And New York, I think, is one of the world-class centers of vegan food and dining.
And anywhere else that was memorable?
There are places, but I want to single them out because they were really exceptionally good.
But you haven't had a problem eating.
Oh, no, I haven't. I wished I had. No, I haven't had a problem eating them.
So what about where you live? Are there some restaurants that you're very fond of?
I live in a very small seaside village on the south coast of England, which doesn't have a lot of options, to be quite honest. But that's okay because we look after ourselves very well with the food that we cook. And we also are very lucky to have made friends with neighbors who have taken on board our veganism. They haven't become vegans themselves, but when they do entertain us, they really work hard to cook us a really delicious vegan meal. So we go around to our friends' homes a lot, and they do justice to us in the food that they provide for us.
That's so lovely.
That is good. But one thing we do have in our town, which is Hastings in East Sussex, is that we do have a vegan dining club.
Wow.
And the Vegan Dining Club meets informally every month or so, and we move around each other's homes and host or do a potluck, and we celebrate our taste in vegan cooking, test out recipes on each other, and bring potluck dishes. We have a vegan cream tea, which is out of this world.
Ooh, I want it.
And
now.
We have, well, I can't bring it to you now, Karen, I'm sorry. But we also have done themed nights, like 1970s vegan cooking nights.
That sounds like fun. You know, we have just a few seconds left. I can't believe we've managed to talk away this hour, but we have. So Growl can be found on Amazon. Where can we get it?
It's available wherever good books are sold, online on Amazon, and through the publisher Lantern Books.
Okay. Thank you, Kim Stallwood, for joining me again on It's All About Food. And remember, everybody, have a delicious week.